For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. Today I speak with Parker Palmer, who holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California at Berkeley, along with 10 honorary doctorates. With Sounds True, Parker has released the audio series An Undivided Life, seeking wholeness in ourselves, our work, and our world. In this episode of the Self-Acceptance Project, I'm speaking with Parker Palmer, someone who I really care about and who always impresses me with the depth and originality from which he speaks, speaking from his heart and his own experience. Parker, welcome to the Self-Acceptance Project.
Thank you, Tammy. So good to be with you again.
To begin with, Parker, I'd love to just understand your take on this division, we could call it, that many people feel inside themselves. With Sounds True, you created a series of teachings on something that you called the undivided life. And yet, for many of us, there's a division inside us, a division of ourselves against ourselves, you could say. What's your understanding of this?
Well, I think we're born into this world with a total embrace of ourselves. Wholeness is what attracts us to infants and young children, I think. Whatever is on the inside comes immediately to the outside, both literally and figuratively. And I think there's something profoundly trustworthy about an infant or a young child that way, and also something poignant that causes us to ask, whatever happened to me? And I think what happens is that the first thing we learn, some kids sadly learn it at home, but most of us learn it at school, is that it's not safe to be out in the world with everything we are, with our identity and our integrity. Gay and lesbian young people learn that very quickly and very painfully and tragically. But all of us have our own version of that in one way or another. It's not safe to be who we are. And so we start building this wall of separation between true self and our public persona or face or mask in an effort to get along and ultimately, I think, to stay safe, what we regard as safety. And eventually that effort to fool the outside world about who we are becomes fooling ourselves. And ultimately, I think the most unsafe place to be is when we're fooling ourselves, when we're not showing up in the world as who we truly are. I'm 74 years old, soon to be 74. And of course, like all aging and older people, I think about the end of life. And I'm quite convinced that the saddest question or insight one could have as one is dying is a sense that I never showed up in the world with my true self during the brief time I had on this earth. And I think living into true self, overcoming the divided life, having the courage to step out from behind that wall, and all of that requires self-acceptance. I think that process is one of the most important life processes that a person can go through.
Now, Parker, what about as somebody steps into more and more of their true self, the criticism that might come in, the rejection that might come in, and all of the ways that that can trigger somebody into something that could be called not self-acceptance, but taking on those criticisms and, you know, really it really hurting inside?
Yeah, it's tough. And if you're any sort of a public person, it's the electronic age, the digital age has made it even tougher because people feel especially free to be cruel in online settings behind anonymity and all of that. So I think, you know, I think one of the part of the life journey for both public and more private people is to do some really careful discerning about criticism. I have to say that one of my reframings of that has had to do with looking back, and I began doing this many years ago, and realizing that some of my most important learnings about myself, learnings that led to growth, came not from my fans, not from the people who loved my books and my talks, but from my critics, because those were the people who caused me to ask important questions about myself. Either did I get it wrong? Is there something here I need to learn? Or did I get it right but not say it in a way that this person could hear? And so I think there's a sort of arena of legitimate criticism that we have to take in and work with as grown-up people. And then there's another force field of rejection, dismissal, marginalization, running all the way to outright hatred that we have to be able to look at and say, that's about them or about that person, not about me. And I'm not saying that these are easy distinctions to make. I'm just, in the course of this brief interview, drawing some lines of distinction that I think are important to work on as time goes by.
Now, Parker, you mentioned two things that I want to draw out, that here you are in your 74th year as an elder, and that when you look at a small newborn, that what you see is their wholeness. And I'm curious, if you were mentoring a young child, a grandchild, or a young child that you cared about, and you were offering that young child, here's your toolbox, if you will, for self-acceptance and self-compassion throughout your life. Here are the main ideas to help you and guide you, what that might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think number one is that I need to be that toolbox or that resource embodied for that young child. And as it happens, I have the very interesting experience of having two granddaughters who are very, very young. They're now 4 and 6. And one granddaughter with whom I've been journeying for 22 years, who essentially lives with my wife and me right now when she's not at college. And so I've had some practice at this, and I've learned along the way. I've made my share of mistakes, and I've had my share of successes around the question you pose. But I think most fundamental to this is to be that adult in, or at least one of the adults in that child's life, who, as someone I once heard said, is simply wild crazy about them, and loves them unconditionally. I was very fortunate to have a father who did that for me. He surrounded me with a kind of love that helped me eventually, I think, achieve self-acceptance, and it was unconditional love. But at the same time, there was expectancy around that, not specific expectations, but expectancy. That he believed in me and believed I could grow and believed I could find my way and believed I could go to places that were worth going to and do things that were worth doing, even at times when I did not believe that about myself, not one little bit. And what's so interesting about that combination of expectancy and unconditional love is that the unconditional love gives you the freedom to take risks into that expectancy. And when you take risks, you're going to fail, but you're free to fail knowing that the love does not depend on you succeeding. And I think that's the message I'd like to embody for my granddaughters and for other young people, excuse me, with whom I come into contact. I think another very important function that elders can play in young people's lives is to be to serve as a kind of memory bank of who these young people were when they came into the world. This child comes in not as a blank slate, not as a blob, but as this kind of person rather than that or that or that. Kids arrive with distinct characteristics, with tropisms. They're attracted to some things, they're repelled by other things. And there's a lot of clues and information in those early years. I write a little bit about this in my book, Let Your Life Speak, that a child, of course, does not have a memory of. But if you, the elder, are the living memory bank for that child and can help them remember that at that early stage of life, you were revealing true self in a way that becomes more hidden as time goes on. I think you can serve a tremendous purpose and give them a tremendous tool in understanding who they really are and coming to accept that unconditionally because you've modeled for them that unconditional love.
Now, Parker, I'm curious in your own life journey, when you think back to those forks in the road where your true self was calling you to do something different and how you navigated those junctures and what you can share with people who might find themselves at a juncture like that where they know there's something off in their life but they're not quite clear or not quite sure how to walk in the direction of their true self.
Yeah, well, I think how to navigate that, how I navigated that was with great difficulty. And I'm not sure I got everything right, of course. We get some things wrong. But I do have vivid memories of various stages of life right up until to the present time when the feeling is that whatever I'm doing is not either not exactly aligned or it's terribly poorly aligned with true self, with my North Star, with my authentic vocation. And so it's risk-taking the whole way. You're entering uncharted territory when you start reaching for something that feels more congruent. I don't know any way to do that other than experimentation. I've always loved the title that Gandhi gave his autobiography, where he called his life My Experiments with Truth. And the truth he meant was both the larger social truth of justice and so forth, but it was also personal truth. Where are my gifts and how do I intersect the world's needs in a fruitful way? So experiments, I mean, the experimental way of living doesn't come with guarantees. As with any experiment, you don't know what the outcome is going to be. And that's why it's an experiment. You can't stay on the rails or inside the box. But at the same time, you don't have to jump over the cliff in a way that is almost certainly going to do you harm. So it's this reaching and this edging forward and this patience and at the same time the willingness to cross boundaries. In my case, again, the story that I about myself that I tell in Let Your Life Speak, and I won't detail it here, but I did a PhD at Berkeley and then immediately decided that academic life was not for me. So I started working my way towards something else, first as a community organizer and then living for 11 years in an intentional Quaker community called Pendle Hill near Philadelphia, a living learning center where we shared everything, and which was arranged as a kibbutz or a commune, or to some extent a monastery might be. And friends would ask me, why are you doing these things which are so counterintuitive, which are so far from the expectations that we all had of you? We expected you to be a young college president or an outstanding scholar or something like that, and you're in these very marginal places conducting experiments. And I would always say, well, the only answer I can give you is that I can't not do it. I can't not do what I'm now doing. And to me, that's always been a truthful and interesting answer, because I'm not saying, oh, I'm just wild crazy about taking these risks with my career, about feeling like I'm disappearing from the map of the known world, about making very little money when I'm helping to raise three children. But there was something inside of me that I kept listening to that was insistent, and that in a quiet but persistent way said, you can't not do this. And tracking through that, following that lead, I think took me eventually to, well, in the words of the old Shaker song, the place just right.
About self-acceptance in terms of one's true self and then this false self that's constructed and the risks that are involved in living more in alignment with one's true self. But I want to shift the conversation slightly and ask you for your insight into a phenomenon that I see inside myself and many other people, which is this negative voice inside. Even when we're taking risks, we're living our life according to what we think is this call of our authenticity, there can be this negative voice inside that says, wow, you really screwed that up, or gosh, you know, are you really sure you wanted to say that or do that? And so there's this thing inside that can feel, for I think many people, a little like an inner battle with this negative self-talk. What's your thinking about that? What's your insight into that?
Well, what you've described corresponds to my own experience. We all have this shadow inside us, this negativity, this tendency to draw ourselves or feel like we're being drawn into the darkness. And as you know, Tammy, three times in my life I've written about this and I speak about it. I've descended into the very dark pit of clinical depression, where you're not just lost in the dark. In some ways, you have become the dark. And one of the hard-won lessons that I try to live pretty close to having had that experience three times, is this, and I'm going to do this in the form of an image. When I look back on my journey toward depression three times in my life, I understand that prior to those descents, it was as if there was someone behind me, maybe a block away, calling my name. Instead of turning around and having a conversation with that person, I kept on walking. I pretended that I didn't hear it because I was scared that it was a voice of utter negativity that I didn't want to hear or have anything to do with. Well, what happens when someone a block behind you gets ignored and you keep walking on? What happens is they step up the pace, they get a little closer, eventually they pick up a pebble, toss it at you, try to get your attention that way. You keep ignoring and you keep walking. Then they pick up a stick and get close enough to whack you with it. And then you keep walking and keep ignoring. And finally, this figure behind you says, "All right, pal, if you won't pay any attention to me at all, then I'll just drop the nuclear bomb on you and try to get your attention that way." So there's a sense in which one of my big learnings from depression was that when I hear that shadow side voice, I need to turn around, I need to walk toward it, and I need to say, "What do you have to say to me? Let's talk." In Prokhorov journaling, people do this in a rather literal way, putting on paper the dialogue with that shadow voice, and that may work for some people. For some of us, it's more of an interior imaginative act, but it's in that dialogue with the inner critic as well as the outer critic that we were talking about earlier that I think we start to make some discernments. Is this a voice that has me, that is trying to tell me something I need to know? Or is this a voice of such irrational negativity that I just need to find a way to say, "Nice to talk, see you around," which is easier to do once you've paid attention to it. You know, I think the greatest need of folks in the external world with whom we're surrounded all the time is to feel like we see them and we hear them. We could avoid a lot of relational problems if we would just pay attention that way. Likewise, I think that the greatest need of some of these inner voices is to feel seen and heard. And there's something simply about having that conversation that mitigates the cruelty of that voice, that amps it down, that eventually helps it, I was going to say dissipate, but I think what I really mean is integrate in some life-giving or healthy way into our the totality of ourselves. I think integration, wholeness, is not about rejecting the shadow side. It's all about the capacity to say, "I am all of the above. I am my darkness as well as my light. I am this self-critical voice as well as this self-affirming voice." And when we're able to develop compassion for ourselves that way, by integrating the shadow and the light, saying, "I am all of the above," we emerge also with more compassion for the world. I won't go into it right now, but Abraham Lincoln is a fascinating case study in that regard. This guy who held the country together at a time when we were approaching national suicide, and did so, I think, to some large extent because he had personally struggled with depression from a very young age and had taken a long journey toward integrating the good guys and the bad guys in himself, and therefore had no need to divide the world into good guys and bad guys. So the stakes here are not only personal, I think they are social as well.
Now, Parker, this image that you're offering of a voice a block away and then getting closer and closer, throwing a rock, getting louder and louder, why is it, do you think, whether from your own experience or imagining other people's experience, someone would just say, you know, I don't want to listen to you. I don't want to listen to you. I don't want to listen to you. Well, why is it so often that we don't turn around and dialogue with those voices?
Well, I think the, you know, we're playing the ostrich game, to use an old metaphor. We're imagining that if we stick our head in the sand, the whole thing will go away. And of course, all we do when we ignore these shadow side forces is we give them greater power over our lives. It's an act of courage to turn around to someone that you think is a threatening presence and say, what do you want? What do you have to say to me? But I think it's an act of foolishness to walk on as if that figure weren't there. So we have to overcome this notion that ignoring problems makes them go away. And that begins in our inner lives, I think, before it can move into the outer world, where we have so many problems that we're pretending don't exist and we walk away from.
Listening to you, what I'm reflecting on is whether it's the voice of an outer critic or an inner one, that in order to listen, we have to take the posture of a learner. And
right.
And that requires also a certain humility that may not be easy for people. I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Absolutely. I'm convinced that a good life, both inwardly and externally, is a balance between chutzpah and humility. And learner is the word for it. The chutzpah to know that I have something to say and the right to say it, and the humility to know that I need to listen to the other, to the critic, to the person who's different from me, who sees things differently, because I may not have the whole truth or even a little bit of the truth. And when you fall into this learning mode, I think, or not just fall into it, but actually practice it, discipline yourself to respond to life that way, things get ever so much richer, and you start not only feeling more at home in the world of the external dialogue and the external critic, you start feeling more at home in your own skin. People sometimes have asked me, you know, how did you feel as you emerged from depression, where you for months were wondering if this would be the day to end your life, you know, and started coming back into a more life-giving space, a space where you could reclaim your energy, your relationships, your work, your own true self. And I've always said, the only real answer I can give you is I felt more at home in my own skin, which I think is a worthy goal in life, because again, that's not just for me. Feeling at home in my own skin means I'm going to be able to help others feel more at home in their skins as well, by feeling more at home in those relationships, even the challenging ones.
Now you use this word discipline, the discipline of taking the posture of being a learner. What is that discipline?
Well, I think it's probably a word that for me is almost synonymous with courage, the courage to turn toward the critic, inner or outer, the courage to understand that I don't have all the answers, I don't have it all together, and that it doesn't matter how old I am or how much experience I have or how much academic or book learning I have or how many hard or good times I've been through. I am a work in progress, as they used to say in the religious tradition that I grew up in. God ain't finished with any of us yet, and so I think the discipline is that existential act of turning toward whatever it is that seems to threaten me rather than away from it. Now, there are all kinds of sort of sub-disciplines that I think support that kind of courage. Journaling does it for some people, and I do some of that. Talking with a therapist or a spiritual guide helps some people along, and that's has been part of my life journey as well. I read a lot of poetry. Certainly I read a lot more poetry than I read psychology or sociology or any of the other disciplines, because the poets, the things we're talking about, Tammy, are things that they're subtle things. You can't run headlong at them in an analytic manner and get very far, but you can glimpse them out of the corner of your eye, and really see something that can change your life. And the poets have this great capacity to help us glimpse things out of the corners of our eyes. That's where they do their seeing, and then they have the gift of being able to put that on the page. Emily Dickinson had this wonderful line, "Tell the truth, but tell it slant." And I think what she was getting at is that there are some truths that are so big and so, and yet at the same time so subtle and nuanced, that you can't run headlong at them and nail them down. You have to tell them on the slant, the way poets do, in order to appropriate them into your life. So I find poets very, very helpful. One that comes quickly to mind is Mae Sarton and her poem, "Now I Become Myself." She talks about this journey toward embracing selfhood. It's a poem that whose first few lines go, "Now I become myself. It's taken time, many years and places. I have been dissolved and shaken, worn other people's faces." And it goes on from there with some very eloquent insights. But just those opening lines, when you're able to look back and say, yeah, I wore other people's faces for a while, and some of those I'm grateful for. I was grateful to be exposed to certain people who had worthy faces, and at a time when I didn't know what my face was, to wear theirs for a while, that of a beloved professor or that of, in my case, my father, to be able to wear that for a while to help find my way in the world until I found my own face and could show it to the world in my own unique way. And being dissolved and shaken, as Mae Sarton says, is part of the way there. And that line causes me to think about those dissolving and shaking moments, and again reframe them as moments of learning and even breakthrough, rather than as moments of breakdown, of which I ought to be ashamed, which I'm not. And the poets have helped me get there.
Parker, I always love talking to you so much. You have so much warmth in your presence. But I am going to ask you just one last question and wrap it up here, which is, throughout our conversation, a couple of times you've made a link between the inner work that a person does and outer challenges in society and the challenges we face as a collective. And I'd love just to end our conversation with you making quite explicit what you see as this work of self-acceptance having to do with making changes in our world at a collective outer level.
Well, thank you, Tammy. It's always a joy to talk with you as well. I'm very clear that racism, homophobia, all forms of hatred are projections of the self-rejecting self, projections of the self that has not been able to integrate all of its parts, its shadow as well as its light, its failures as well as its success. And instead of undertaking that hard inner work of integration, has had to find a scapegoat in the external world. And what is racism or scapegoating or, racism or homophobia or any form of hatred except scapegoating? So the stakes are high. This is where I come to the belief that anything we can do for ourselves along the lines of self-acceptance or any other form of interior growth toward wholeness and well-being is ultimately being done on behalf of other people. It's not a selfish act as it's sometimes treated. And I think that sense of selfishness is one of the things that sometimes keeps people away from doing work around things like self-acceptance. The very phrase self-acceptance sounds on the face of it to be maybe something selfish or narcissistic, but I deeply believe that it is not. On the contrary, it's work being done on behalf of the common good. If I can be in the world in a self-accepting way, whether that's with my granddaughters or with my colleagues or with my ostensible opponents and enemies, I'm going to be there as a healer rather than a wounder. I'm going to be there as one more weaver of a good society rather than somebody who's tearing that fabric apart. And just one more time, if somebody wants to delve into the larger reaches of this, I'll recommend two books. One of them is mine, a recent book called Healing the Heart of Democracy, where I try to draw some of these connections between the inner and outer life in our society that is so politically dysfunctional right now and so riddled with division. Quick example, I take what's called the politics of hate, the politics of rage, and translate that into what I call the politics of the brokenhearted. I think brokenheartedness about the condition of the contemporary world is one of the great drivers behind this divisiveness and these animosities. But I think when we diagnose it as the politics of rage, we come up with the wrong prescription. I think the politics of the brokenhearted is a much better diagnosis and leads us to ask the question, how can we heal these hearts, starting with ourselves? And the other book I'd highly recommend is by Joshua Wolf Schenck, and it's called Lincoln's Melancholy. I mentioned earlier in the interview that Abraham Lincoln, from a very young age, suffered from clinical depression so badly that neighbors would take him in when he was 19, 20, 21 years old to watch over him for a week or two to make sure that he didn't take his own life. And he struggled with depression until the day of his death. But he integrated, had taken this lifelong journey toward integrating the shadow and light in himself, not dividing himself into the good guys and the bad guys, but seeing himself as all of the above, which gave him, which made him really providentially the president we needed at a time when this country did not need a leader who was saying, you're the good guys and you're the bad guys and we are going to vanquish you. He said, we're all in this together, and God isn't on either side. The question is, are we on God's side? And by that, he didn't mean anything narrowly doctrinal or creedal, but he was appealing to what he called the better angels of our nature, because he knew that embracing the lesser angels of our nature was part of the way to get there, and that we all had them. There was no Mason-Dixon line between lesser angels and the better angels. So I appreciate the opportunity to say very explicitly, this is not about narcissism, self-acceptance. This is not selfishness, self-acceptance. This is about becoming a person who can carry that gift of wholeness into a larger world where it's badly needed, not only by other individuals, but by society as a whole in the way we approach our problems, because we are all in this together.
I've been speaking with Parker Palmer as part of the Self-Acceptance Project. Parker, a world-renowned writer, speaker, and activist, founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal, and with Sounds True, has created a series of teachings on the undivided life. Again, Parker, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tammy.
SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.